Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. On today's show, we're looking at yesterday's vote in the U.S. House of Representatives on the GOP health care bill. Also, the battle over the push to rescind the Bears Ears National Monument intensifies. Plus, high-profile resignations at the University of Utah in the wake of a power struggle at the Huntsman Cancer Institute, and the Utah Transit Authority's past comes back to haunt it once again. And joining me on the phone today is Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Berg. Good morning, Tommy.
Hey, good morning.
And in studio, we've got reporter Lee Davidson. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning.
Also, Benjamin Wood. Welcome to you, and good morning.
Good morning.
And columnist Robert Gerke. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
Listeners, you can join the conversation during this Friday morning news wrap-up by posting your questions and comments at sltrib.com or calling us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. And Thomas Berg, we're going to go to you first today. The House of Representatives held a vote on health care yesterday. Repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, was a campaign mantra, and that's what this bill intends to do, but it was kind of a rushed vote. Tell us what happened.
You know, it was a rushed vote, and this is something that was supposedly going to be done in January, according to the president's campaign mantra. But they tried this once before, and it didn't work out. They had to pull the bill because they didn't have enough votes. Some last-minute willing and dealing this week to get some of the right flank on the agenda. The vote actually passed 217 to 213, so they got one more vote than they needed. And one of those happened to be Representative Jason Chaffetz, who says he ignored his doctor's advice, and after he had foot surgery last week, flew into Washington and actually rode this little knee scooter into the Capitol to make the vote.
And some people I know pointed out that this was surgery that he'd had for his own pre-existing condition, and that this was a bit of an irony in voting something away. Well, maybe you can explain a little bit about what this this bill would do, because one of those is one of those conditions is giving a waiver to states when it comes to enforcing the pre-existing condition requirement in healthcare.
Yeah, sure. It's a little complicated, but essentially it's this. Right now, under the Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act, no insurance can deny you or charge you a higher fee just because you have a pre-existing condition. That is essentially the case under the Republican bill, except for this. So if you're in a state, say you're in Utah, and the state asks for a waiver and the federal government grants one, you could then charge someone a higher rate for a pre-existing condition if they've gone, I think, 63 days without health care, if they've had some kind of lapse in health care. And there are a lot of people concerned about that. Say you leave a job and you don't immediately have health care, you're fired, you're laid off, you want to start your own business, whatever it is. So somebody who has MS, for example, I talked to a woman in Utah who's very concerned about that. She owns her own business. She's worried about, you know, these changes. What if happens if the business doesn't do well or something like that? She's without health care for a bit. She goes to get it again. They can charge up to like five times more than she was paying before.
Okay, so that's, I mean, that was a popular part of Obamacare, was the requirement that insurance companies cover these pre-existing conditions. Is there, I mean, I guess I'm wondering if lawmakers were hearing from the public on this in advance of the vote.
Oh, I think there's no question. And polls have shown that Obamacare has become actually more popular under this president in the last 6 months or so. You've seen people who are like, wait, I actually do understand now what I've been getting with Obamacare, despite all the rhetoric. And, yeah, I mean, there was a protest in Salt Lake City last night, and they're going to continue to be protests. Let's just remember, though, this is the first step in many ways. Republicans still have to, in the House, still have to do more work. This bill is headed to the Senate, where senators are already talking about the idea of starting over and doing their own bill and not even paying attention to what the House just passed. So this is a long road to actually making this happen as Republicans wanted to.
Just to get this out of the way, did all of Utah's representatives vote for this bill?
Yes, they did. I was there at the Capitol yesterday trying to find Jason on his new scooter, and excuse me, Congressman Chaffetz. And I did. I talked to Congressman Bishop. I could not find Congressman Mia Love or Congressman Chris Stewart, but they did all vote for the bill.
Okay, and you know, we mentioned that this was seemingly kind of a rush to get enough support, and therefore a rushed process to get it passed. Did lawmakers, did they understand entirely what it was that they were voting for yesterday? Were they? I mean, go ahead.
It's a good question. You know, the Republicans came into office this year, and they promised as part of their platform that everything that they would vote on would be posted 48 hours ahead of time online, that they would never do something like they did yesterday, where literally the bill was inked the night before, the bill text was out, but you really didn't even have time to read it. I just saw a report this morning, a congressman, I think, from New York's like, yeah, I didn't read it. So I kind of doubt that anyone actually had the full comprehension of what was inside what they were voting on.
And as you said, this is going to go to the Senate now, a little bit more deliberative process in that chamber, I'm assuming?
Yeah, and I think it's a more difficult process because they have to get 60 votes. There's always the, you know, 51 votes to pass it. But if you have to get through a cloture process, which I'm sure Democrats will try to filibuster any move, you're going to need 60 votes. And there's also a lot more moderate Republicans who are concerned about some of the changes here. For example, the change on a state can also ask for a waiver on essential health care benefits. Those are benefits for maternity care, for mental health benefits. So there's really some problematic poison pills inside this House measure that are going to face a very stiff challenge in the Senate.
You know, Robert Gerke, healthcare. Robert, you're a columnist, so I'm going to give you that that sort of leverage or whatever leeway. You can say what you want to say. Healthcare in America seems a little bit like political football, but then maybe everything is political football. Is that ever going to stop when it comes to how we think about and debate things like healthcare?
Well, probably not, because we have our healthcare system has a lot of problems, and there need to be fixes to it, and there's just a vast disagreement between Republicans and Democrats on how to do that. It's hard, frankly, to see how this bill is going to solve any of those problems. I mean, we talked about $800 billion in Medicaid cuts. It's going to eliminate coverage to 14 million people, things like that. And so, you know, that it's hard to see what the upside to that is. We're removing subsidies for lower income people while giving them to higher income people with this bill. We're not covering pre-existing conditions. And the fact of the matter is that the Obamacare, for all of its flaws, and it's far from perfect, but for all of its flaws, did reduce the number of uninsured in this country and got coverage to more people and probably improved the health care outcomes and saved some lives. And so that's what we're talking about getting rid of now. And Republicans are dead set on doing it. I think Tommy hit on the head that the Senate, you know, they have some real problems with the Medicaid cuts. They have some problems with some of the other provisions in it. And it's going to probably look very different than when it's finished than it did when it came out of the House.
I mean, is this really just, and Tommy, going back to you, is this really just about fulfilling a campaign promise more than doing something specifically on healthcare? That's maybe a cynical way of looking at it, but in some ways, especially if you haven't read the bill, that could be what you might see here.
You know, I've been in Washington 12 years now. I don't want to be that much of a cynic, but you know, this is a lot about messaging. I think they do want to do something. They obviously think there are problems with Obamacare, and there are. Look, they're in Iowa now. One of their largest insurance providers just pulled out of Obamacare, leaving I think 93 counties really without much of a choice. So there are issues, like Gerke talked about. But in many ways, this is one of many steps they're going to have to take to replace this. This was not the big victory. Trump corralled a whole bunch of members of Congress behind him at the Rose Garden yesterday to declare, take a victory lap. But in many ways, this is really just step one of 300 that they're going to have to take.
And one other point I want to make is that this looks like, we haven't seen a budget scoring on this yet because it was rushed through so fast. But the talk is that it's going to increase the deficit and provide coverage to millions of fewer people. So that's hard to pitch that as a victory when when people lose their health care and our debt goes up.
Well, maybe a premature victory lap there. But how about in terms of do we know what it will do to premiums? Do we know how it might affect costs of health care yet? Have we had much analysis on that, Tommy?
No, and I think that's the problem. I think what Gerke was just talking about is exactly right. The CBO has not scored this. We haven't really had the full analysis because the bill was just finalized, less than 48 hours ago. So, no, we don't know. The last CBO scoring showed, billions of dollars in debt this is going to take us into, and the fact that 24 million people could lose health insurance. This one, we're not yet sure how much more it's going to add to the debt, but it will. There's no question about that.
I mean, there are a few things I think we do know, though, that for example, by eliminating a lot of the subsidies that were available to people to buy on the private market under Obamacare, those people's premiums are going to go up. The minimum coverage, as Tommy mentioned earlier, is going to, the essential benefits are going to go away, which means maybe plans can offer some lower cost, but also lower benefit coverage. For example, they wouldn't necessarily offer, they wouldn't cover pre-existing conditions. They wouldn't cover things like mental health, psychological, counseling and so forth. There are some options where we could see some premium costs going down. There's also a provision in there that's kind of interesting where even if you aren't buying on the private market, if you get employer-based insurance, your deductibles could go up and your caps could disappear. Mm-hmm. Right now there's a cap, so if you have a catastrophic illness, you're only going to pay about, I think it's $400,000, if I remember, and that would go away.
Tommy, will the Senate wait for a score from the CBO before making its vote?
No, I don't think so. From what I hear from the Senate right now is they're going to start over. They're not going to really take up this House bill because they see so many problems with it. So, we will get a CBO score at some point, but it's not really going to matter. The Senate's going to write their own.
And if I can make one real short point, I think what's going to be real interesting is the political cost that some of these representatives are going to pay as a result of this. Because, for example, in California, 7 reps who voted whose districts were won by Hillary Clinton voted for this bill. There's going to be a political toll paid by the Republicans, I think, on this bill in 2018.
Okay.
Which is why the Democrats were all singing, hey, goodbye when this bill passed.
Wow. Well, I don't know. Is that hubris, though? We'll see. We're going to come back to the world of medicine with a story a little bit closer to home later in the show. But for now, actually, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, the continued push to rescind the Bear's Ears National Monument, as well as the movement in opposition to that push, that's coming up next here on Behind the Headlines.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, education reporter Benjamin Wood, government reporter Lee Davidson, and Tribune columnist Robert Gerke. Join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. And we're going to turn now to the Bear's Ears National Monument. Thomas Burr, last week the president signed an executive order to essentially reconsider national monuments. And this week we heard from tribal leaders who say that when it comes down to it, that if Trump does rescind the Bear's Ears National Monument, they'll go to court to fight that. And I think they're not the only ones saying that. Tell us about this part of the story, Tommy.
Yeah, sure. I think we should start with more of their optimism, which is they're hoping, and I believe from our sources told us that the Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is going to meet with some of the tribal leaders when he visits Monday and Tuesday to Utah. And they were really making a plea this week. They were asking, please listen to us. We've been asking for a monument for a long time, protect these, cultural ancestral sites that are really important to them. But as part of that plea was also a little bit of a threat. If the Interior Secretary recommends they rescind the monument and President Trump falls through, they're not going to stand idly by and they're going to sue. I think we have several environmental groups who are also lined up to do that because there's still a question whether the president has the power to get rid of a monument. It's very clear they have a power to create one, but we're not sure they can get rid of one. And it's never been legally tested. So this is a long battle that's lining up right now, and everyone's getting ready.
Well, and you mentioned that Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is now reviewing national monument designations. What kind of a review are we talking about here?
So You know, he's actually going on the ground. So what I understand is the Interior Secretary is going to fly into Salt Lake, have some meetings there, go down and see Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, meet with, you know, county commissioners, congressional members, you know, local residents, and kind of do on the ground look at what are the impacts of a national monument and how they affected the community. But it's a very, very short time frame. The Interior Secretary has only until about June 10, so about a month and 5 days left, to report back to the president on Bears Ears. And then he has 120 days to report back on the other 25 to 30 monuments that have been created in the last couple of decades. So it's not like you can go really deep on these things. This is a little more of a cursory look because of the time constraints.
Hey, am I remembering correctly that as a congressman in Montana, Zinke was seen as maybe a little bit antagonistic to the land transfer movement, and that's the movement to have federal public lands ceded to the states. And how does that play into how he looks at things like national monuments, if I am remembering it correctly?
You're remembering it correctly, yes. And it's actually kind of fascinating. In fact, when Zinke did a briefing at the White House a couple weeks ago, I was there, and one of the questions we asked was about that, and he stood very by his point that he does not believe that federal land should be transferred. He doesn't believe in selling off federal lands or, you know, conveying them in some form, letting them be managed by a state or another entity. He's very strong on that. However, that's different than the idea of returning, say, taking a monument and returning it back to being BLM and Forest Service lands, where they're still owned and managed by the federal government.
Okay. You know, Zinke's going to be here, as you said, in Salt Lake City for a short stint this weekend before heading to southern Utah. There's also a rally planned here, I'm guessing an attempt to send a message. Just Robert Gerke, as a columnist, I want to bring you in on this. You wrote a column about this, about the review that Zinke is conducting in particular, and you called it a charade.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any question what the outcome of this review is going to be. They'll use it to find some justification to prop up the decision that's already been made to either rescind or shrink the monument. And then it'll end up going to court, as Tommy mentioned. The groups are already lining up to challenge whatever he ends up doing, whether it's shrinking or rescinding it. I think we can probably safely assume that we know it won't be left as is, which I think really should be done, because the on-the-ground impact of the monument designation is pretty minimal. There's existing roads remain, you know, open. Existing mining, existing grazing, existing oil and gas development on the monument all are, you know, carry on as is. And so the on-the-ground impact is pretty minimal. But, you know, they're responding to this outcry from the delegation and from some of the people in San Juan County. We're headed toward, I think, a move by the Interior Department and by Donald Trump to rescind or to at least drastically shrink this monument.
Thomas Burr, on that point, Robert Gerke says that not much on the ground has changed as a result of the monument designation. If that's the case, then the push to rescind it is about, well, I guess that's the question. What is it about?
Nothing's really happened much. I mean, this is the monument's only, 5 months old in many ways. So there's not really much change that has happened yet. But a lot of changes could happen.
Right.
I think we should also focus on Grand Staircase right now.
Yeah.
This is a 21-year-old monument. This is not something that's very new, and so there have been a lot of changes there on how it's managed and what, you know, you can do on said monument. But there are ideas that Congressman Stewart, for example, wants to open up some coal tracks inside Bears Ears, and I think there would be a huge push to do the same in Grand Staircase, where the monument was designated in part to stop some big coal mine operations happening down there. So there would be some huge implications.
Yeah, and I do hope when Secretary Zinke goes down to Escalante, he spends some time at those businesses that have cropped up outside the monument, the lodges and the restaurants and the outfitters that have popped up there that weren't there before to support, you know, that are there now to support the recreation opportunities on the monument.
That's Robert Gerke. Tommy, you know, what about why the time frame of reviewing national monuments that goes back to 1996? Couldn't it go back quite a bit further?
It was clearly done to include Grand Staircase. I mean, this was a lot of Senator Orrin Hatch picking up the phone and calling President Trump I don't know if it was daily, but often, apparently, enough that President Trump was a little irritated enough to be like, well, I guess I'll review these monuments. Maybe irritated is not the right word, but I think that they want action. They want something to report back to constituents. The Utah delegation is very big on this, and as I've noted several times before, President Trump needs Orrin Hatch because Orrin Hatch is the chairman of the Finance Committee. He holds a lot of sway in the Senate. And if they want to get something like tax reform done, if they want to get the health care bill through the Senate, they're going to need Orrin Hatch. So this was a favor back to him.
I do think this review probably buys them some time, too. I mean, it would have been just as easy for them, you know, since we have sort of concluded that they already have made up their mind that they're going to tinker with this monument somehow. But this buys them some time to figure out if A, they can legally rescind a monument, which, to Tommy, as Tommy mentioned, is the big untested question right now, and just sort of figure out their plan of attack. And so I think that's part of it, is this gives them a little bit of breathing room. To you know, we're doing something, but we're not necessarily doing it all right now.
Thomas Burr, I know you've got to go here in a moment, but just when Ryan Zinke is here, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is here in Utah, who is he actually traveling with, and who will he be meeting?
You know, I think that's still a little bit unclear, but what I've heard from sources is that, you know, he's going to meet with some, you know, like I said, congressional members probably going to be around. He's going to meet with some Indian tribes. He's going to meet with some local, you know, elected officials and some state officials. You know, I assume it'll be a nice big traveling entourage going through the state. But it's pretty quick. I mean, just traveling to Bears Ears takes some time. I assume maybe they'll fly, but it's 1.35 million acres. He's not going to be able to see very much of it in the 48 hours or so he's going to be in the state.
Right. Well, okay, Thomas Burr, I know you're going to move on to other things, and so we'll let you do that. But thanks for being here today. It's Thomas Burr, Salt Lake Tribune's Washington Bureau Chief. Thanks again, Tommy.
Thank you.
Still to come on the show, the Utah Transit Authority sees old scandals come back to haunt it, and also the latest in the upheaval at the University of Utah and the Huntsman Cancer Institute. Maybe we'll take a quick break, though, and come back after a minute's time. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. A short break, and then we'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined for the remainder of this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Lee Davidson, Benjamin Wood, and Robert Gerke. Listeners, join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com, the Behind the Headlines page currently live there. Lee Davidson, to you now. You've had a series of stories over the past few weeks, actually stories that go back a lot longer than that, on the Utah Transit Authority. The agency in years past got into some hot water because of sweetheart deals with developers who had cozy relationships with UTA board members. And now a new story that's come out this week involves Utah House Speaker Greg Hughes from his tenure as board chair there. It's something that the Tribune is looking into. Tell us about this, Lee Davidson.
Well, some questions have arisen about favoritism for a business partner and friend of Hughes named Kevin Gern, who was a former majority leader of the Utah House. Back in April 2011, the two of them formed a company together, seeking to construct an apartment building in downtown Salt Lake City. 5 months later, another company that Garn is a partner in won several big agreements with UTA to build transit-oriented developments around rail stops. In the next 2 years, his company would win 7 of those deals out of 12 total that UTA was trying to do. Greg Hughes never disclosed his relationship with Garn on conflict of interest forms. He says he didn't have to because the project that they were seeking to build never came to fruition. So he said the company they formed was just an early part of organization, so, gee, he didn't have to disclose it and never did.
But they still would have, I mean, just to clarify on that point, they still would have had a business relationship, Kevin Garn and Greg Hughes, at the time, board chair of UTA.
The company they formed lasted for about 2 years before it was allowed to expire. But Hughes contends it wasn't really a business relationship because they didn't build anything. Others may disagree.
So essentially, there's nothing to see here because the business in question didn't get off the ground. I don't know. He also said that he didn't know. Speaker Hughes says to you this week that he didn't know that the company that Garn run had won these contracts until the Tribune came asking about this.
Well, he said he didn't know at the time.
Okay.
Even though the name of the company is Thackeray Garn, the word Garn is in the company.
That could have been Jake Garn. I mean, I just guess.
Yeah. He says that the board's involved at kind of the 30,000-foot altitude level and didn't get that involved in the details. However, the board does hear updates on transit-oriented developments, and it does approve contracts.
Something about this, well, it sounds really familiar, and it's the idea that those transit-oriented developments, this is kind of the reason that there is a federal investigation underway of Utah Transit Authority, if I'm not mistaken. This is for land deals that have benefited people close to UTA. And maybe we can jump into that for just a second. What is this federal investigation seeking, or what do we know about it so far?
Well, it's looking at many things. Among things that they have said they are looking at are transit-oriented developments and real estate deals involving UTA and past board members. There's a past board member named Terry Dill who has been indicted for allegedly not disclosing, making false statements in a bankruptcy filing, and for not disclosing up to more than $1 million that he supposedly received in a UTA-related deal.
Okay.
You know, we asked Hughes if he thought he had any influence on Garn winning these contracts. He said no. We asked UTA the same question, and they said they couldn't comment because of the ongoing federal investigation.
Were the real estate deals in question, these transit-oriented developments, was the bidding process competitive for these, or was it all, you know, backroom deals, or do we know?
It was competitive. People would submit proposals or why they were qualified to do it. Once they were selected as partners, they had the duty to come up with site plans with local cities and others about what they proposed. Normally, they were trying to attract more retail, office, and apartments so that there'd be more people living around a rail stop, so it would increase ridership on UTA.
Hmm. Because of the investigation, but in the wake of some public outcry over a number of things, UTA has been going through kind of reform process. Is that correct? And where does that process stand?
They say they are trying to be more open and transparent. They've adopted a lot of new ethics rules, including rules that clearly would have required Hughes to disclose his relationship. Under rules at the time, members had the responsibility to choose themselves if they had a potential conflict of interest and to disclose it. Now they have to pretty much disclose any kind of business deal they're in, and then UTA looks at it and sees if it's a problem or not, works on it.
Robert Gerke, Salt Lake Tribune columnist, reform efforts apparently underway at UTA, taking a dispassionate look at what happened in the past is key to being able to reform any organization. Is that happening in your mind?
Well, it's happening, but it's happening too late and too slowly. The UTA board should have been blown up years ago. The governor should have taken more control over this and completely overhauled the way they do it. And as a result, we end up with this the situation we're in now. I think probably the most promising development in terms of the reform efforts is the appointment of this monitor who's going to oversee the UTA operations for 3 years. There had been questions about this for years. There had been questions about the way the members of the board were appointed by the various parties, and instead of, you know, some instead of stepping in and taking control, the legislature and the governor just sort of let it play out. And so regardless of whether Greg Hughes made money or Kevin Gard made money on this deal, the failure to disclose it just gives the appearance of more cronyism inside UTA, and that's what we're dealing with Terry Deal. I mean, there are degrees of cronyism, I guess. There's illegal cronyism or potentially illegal cronyism in the case of Terry Deal, and there's the appearance of cronyism that we have, at least in this case with Greg Hughes. And this goes back to a criticism that people have leveled against UTA for a long time, is that they moved from being a transit agency to being a development agency, and that made a lot of people a lot of money over a fairly short period of time, especially people who were well connected to the board members of UTA.
But fulfilling the transit mission, I mean, is there a review of that that's been done, maybe at the state level, to see that that's being done up to spec?
The UTA's fulfilling the transit mission.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that people are largely content with UTA's transit options it provides. You know, I mean, yes, people want to see expanded service and reduced fares and things like that. That's going to be, you know, come with the territory. Where they sort of stray into these, being this major sort of player in the development of these multi-use developments, is that really where they're supposed to be spending taxpayer money, and you've got not only the areas they've developed, they also happen to be a pretty major land holder and have all these real estate holdings that they're just banking essentially for potential future purposes, and so is that really their mission, and that's what the board was there to kind of keep them focused on, and they didn't do it. And nobody stepped in and said to the board, you know, nobody from the legislature to the governor said to the board, you know, we need to change our focus and change our mission.
There are questions about its transit mission also. It is heavily in debt. It took on $2 billion worth of debt to accelerate its expansion of its tracks lines and front runner lines.
Did some of that money end up in the hands of these developers who were friends of board members?
Well, that's a question.
Okay.
that's one of the criticisms, that they were focusing on these other things while they were building this big debt. They now spend more on debt service every year than they do on bus service. That is preventing them from doing some other expansion that they'd like to do, more weekend service, more night service, that sort of thing, which is the sort of thing a lot of interest groups have been pushing for. Instead of new shiny rail lines or streetcar lines, they want more bus service. And the agency says they hear that criticism, they've been moving that way, but frankly, they're in a financial position where it's hard to do that.
In terms of this federal investigation, do we have a sort of time frame of how it will roll out, when I'm thinking about, especially if there is, you know, we're hearing the name Greg Hughes thrown around as the Tribune looks into this relationship that he had with Kevin Garn and what that may have, how that might have affected the contracts that Kevin Garn's company received. Political fallout is potential here.
Well, Hughes is talked about as a candidate for Congress to replace Jason Chaffetz, and he's been in discussions with the Trump administration for a variety of transit posts. This could fall into that and complicate that. As far as how long this may take, we don't know. There is going to be a federal monitor overlooking UTA for at least 3 years. It's kind of dribs and drabs of other information. Hughes's lawyer has said that he met with federal investigators and was told he was not a target of their probe.
Hmm. Okay. That's according to Hughes' lawyers. Have you heard that from you're not hearing much from the federal investigators, I take it?
They haven't said, as far as I know,
okay.
Publicly.
Okay. I think we should probably leave it there. It's a really interesting story. Actually, can we just for a moment stick with UTA and the reform efforts underway there? You wrote also this week, Lee Davidson, about a new UTA board member and some sort of infighting going on at the board of the UTA. Maybe you could tell us about this. It's sort of a flap-up on the board.
Right. This new member is named Brent Taylor. He's the mayor of North Ogden. And he was actually in a fight for several months trying to get on the board and was being blocked by board members. That's because they say that his dad is a front-runner train operator, and they said it would violate nepotism rules. He said it was because he vowed to reform the agency and to reduce its high executive salaries. And he said that written nepotism rules didn't ban him from becoming a board member. After much infighting and changing, at one point, even UTA vowed to fire his father if he insisted on taking his board seat. State Auditor John Dougal weighed in, looked at the written policies, and he said, Taylor's right. Nothing bans him from serving on the board, but his dad cannot be promoted or transferred while he does. So Taylor's on the board, and the board changes its nepotism rules, so it won't affect Taylor, but in the future, anyone in his position, if they take the board seat and they have a relative who works for UTA, that relative will be fired. So we did a story where he said, you know, that's not so much about ethics as it is the board attacking me again and trying to make me feel illegitimate. The vice chairwoman of the board exploded on Facebook and said a lot of nasty things about Taylor and the situation. And that is Sherry Hall Everett, who is a candidate for Mayor of Provo. And one of her candidacy promises is to keep things civil. And she kind of went overboard a bit on Facebook. And so Taylor responds by calling for her resignation and the resignation of the chairman of the board because of their months of fighting. And he's saying this is kind of a symptom of UTA. You know, they're too sensitive to criticism. They don't really look at their problems. And, you know, they circle around each other. Sherry Hall Everett apologized for being too personal. The chairman of the board made no comment. And that's kind of where things stand now.
We don't know if there's been a sort of makeup moment on the board between between the new board member.
I don't know. Things have progressed where there may not be a makeup moment for any time in the foreseeable future between them.
And what about that idea of him being a reformer trying to lower executive salaries? Is that that's something that UTA is already committed to doing to some extent, right?
Well, a lot of the past people are no longer there. They've been replaced, and they were replaced with people who have somewhat lower salaries. And UTA has vowed to try to keep it down.
Okay.
We did get word in the last 2 weeks that UTA had canceled a couple of bonuses, one of almost $500,000 to a former general counsel who retired. It was a deferred bonus to give him that much for simply selecting 5 transit-oriented development sites. Mm-hmm. Not building them, not completing them, but just selecting them.
Just being there to select them.
It was $500,000. UTA saw it and managed to cancel it.
Okay. I think we're going to have to leave it there. We won't have any time left for Benjamin Wood, but thank you very much for this update, Lee Davidson, and your reporting on the Utah Transit Authority. Ben Wood, thank you for your patience here on the show, and let's just jump right in. And it's an update to a story that we've been talking about for, I think, 3 weeks now, the power struggle at the Huntsman Cancer Institute, or maybe between HCI and the University of Utah. And the fallout from that struggle since last Friday, some of that new fallout came in the form of a couple of resignations, or at least one resignation, and one that was maybe already planned but possibly sped up as a result. Take us through what happened, Ben.
Yeah, and like you said, it's hard to remember what happened since the last time we talked, since we have talked about this so much.
Right.
But at this point, Dr. Vivian Lee, who is a senior vice president at the U over health sciences, she has announced her resignation. She may stay on as a tenured faculty member. That she stated she will. I think there is some suspicion that might not stick for too long. And then President Pershing, the university president, has also announced that he will resign as soon as a replacement is found. We've talked to a lot of people who say that was in the works, that he intended to announce that in August. It sounds like he bumped up that announcement a little bit, one would assume, as part of the ongoing upheaval at the U.
And again, okay, so we should maybe just go through the basics again. This stems from some upheaval at Huntsman Cancer Institute. It's actually the firing of the head of HCI by the University of Utah, by the president's office, Mary Beckerle, who was a sort of well-known figure in cancer research and hospitals around the country, had been at Huntsman for quite a while, was fired in an email. And that led to this sort of explosion of things involving John Huntsman Sr., the sort of patriarch of the Huntsman family, who's the big donor to, obviously, the Huntsman Cancer Institute.
Correct. Mary Beckerle was abruptly fired by email. That led to vocal criticisms by both faculty at the HCI and the Huntsman family, whose name is on the building.
Okay, and also on the masthead of the Salt Lake Tribune, because you have as your publisher, I'm blanking on his name, Paul Huntsman. There we go. Just as a caveat there, I guess, to throw out there. What did Vivian Lee, who was the CEO of U of U Healthcare, what did she say about her stepping down? And so she's not out of a job, maybe, we don't know yet, but what did she say in her sort of resignation letter?
So Vivian Lee's voice has been the notably absent element in all of this story. As try as we might, we have been repeatedly denied access to Vivian. You know, her resignation was fairly perfunctory, the type of academic resignation you expect, pursuing other avenues and, you know, et cetera. We really don't know much about her motivations, her decision-making, or what prompted things from her side. There's a lot of theory out there, much of which is anonymous, and it kind of links together to various pictures, but we really don't know what was behind her decision to fire Becker Lee or behind her decision to step down.
Okay, so still not really known exactly why that happened, but of course the fallout is big, and you know we said that you know that Pershing, University of Utah President David Pershing, was stepping down. When he announced his retirement, did he reference this sort of flare up at all?
Not directly. As he said, you know, the line has always been that he intended to step down at the end of the year anyway, and that he was merely moving up that announcement. He plans to stay on and help with the transition. He'll be in place until a replacement is found, which, you know, I talked to Dave Buehler, the commissioner of higher education. That process can often take up to a year. So, I mean, David Pershing is going to be around for a bit longer, and he'll be helping with the transition.
But there is a replacement who's been announced, or an interim replacement who's been announced for Vivian Lee, who was the head, you know, the CEO of U of U Healthcare, and had a parallel role that I can't think of now.
Correct. Loris Betts, he formerly held that position, so he's been instated to, essentially, he's retaken the position he used to have on an interim basis until a replacement is found.
Okay. And so we wait and see what happens next. I'm going to bring in Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke on this common mistake. I'm sorry to both of you. And I guess, you know, what does this say about the University of Utah or about Huntsman Cancer Institute? I don't know.
What a mess, right? I mean, I've compared it a few times to Game of Thrones. It's just, you know, you've got to, there's like palace intrigue and there's people getting knocked off and, you know, it's been pretty astonishing to watch it play out and just sort of try to wrap your head around how horribly the whole thing was handled. You know, you've got to figure that somewhere along the line, somebody should have thought about the fact that the Huntsman family might be a little upset by the fact that they're going to go ahead and just bump off his, you know, his handpicked successor. I mean, she was protected by the guy who, again, $130 million gift that they were negotiating, and they're going to jeopardize that by taking this action. It's just been terribly handled. I think it's been damaging to the university medical school and to the Huntsman Cancer Institute. I think they'll recover, but I think it's going to take some time. And it was also interesting to sort of see the outpouring of the protests of the, you know, the staff and the researchers up there in favor of Becker Lee. And you know, that sort of is not something that you expect to see all that often, this sort of activism. But, you know, now I guess it's a matter of putting the things back together and trying to move on.
Ben Wood, is this, I mean, we don't really know, but is this kind of about differing visions for the Huntsman Cancer Institute from both the institute itself, who's at the head, Mary Becker Lee, the Huntsman family, and the University of Utah?
That's the sense that many sources seem to be pointing to, that, you know, it's managerial styles, it's personalities, it's, you know, a different visions for the future of HCI. You know, we have received some documents from the U detailing the arrangements dating back to the initial creation of the institute. We're looking through those now. You know, there is, as you read through those, and we've reported on them a little bit, just the changing structure as the institute has over time gotten more and more autonomy. You know, it does sound like people do believe that might have played a role in perhaps the university trying to reel it back in, competing visions, like you said. But to Robert Gerke's point, you know, a lot of this has been characterized as a battle between the universities and the Huntsmans, but the faculty demonstrations that was what kicked off our coverage. We were at a faculty meeting where the, you know, staff of the HSI were chanting Vivian Leigh has got to go and screaming with signs that say Save Mary. So I mean, there the outpouring of the rank and file staff of the institute has also been quite notable.
Okay, Ben Wood, thank you very much for this update, and I'm sorry to say that we've come to the end of the show, and we'll need to turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. And Ben, maybe I'll just stick with you if you've got one ready. What's your underplayed story of the week?
Well, speaking of higher ed, it is graduation season. Right. My colleagues at the health education environment desk have been writing some really nice features about the class of 2017. Today there's one from Salt Lake Community College, a non-traditional student. I want to say a septuagenarian.
She was 80-year-old
octogenarian
from Thailand. And yeah.
Yeah, so just a series of charming stories about students who, you know, have overcome the odds and completed their education. I always enjoy reading stories like that.
Okay. Lee Davidson, how about you? A pick for underplayed story of the week.
Well, for the first time ever, a majority of U.S. households have only a cell phone and not a landline also. And it's just a sign that technology continues to change, sometimes quietly. But that change also creates challenges and such things as polling.
Right. Right, so. Because getting access to cell phone numbers is a little bit harder than access to landlines. I'm actually surprised that that didn't happen, this changeover didn't happen earlier in time. Kind of surprising to me. I don't know why. This is people who only have cell phones.
Right. And I think it did happen a lot quicker with younger folk, but okay. It's been a little slower with the older people like me.
All right. That is Lee Davidson's pick for underplayed story. Robert Gerke, yours.
Mine's from a story that ran, I believe, a week ago. Taylor Anderson has been doing some really good reporting on this. There was a death in the Duchesne County Jail, Madison Jensen. She's a 21-year-old woman who was ill, vomiting and so forth, and then ended up dead in her jail cell. The family is, you know, thinks that there was negligence on the part of the Duchesne County Sheriff, and so. But it's been interesting to watch Taylor roll this out, and so it was worth a read if you didn't see it last week.
Okay. Well, mine's not nearly as serious as yours or as the others actually, but Salt Lake Tribune film critic Sean Means wrote about the Tower Theater here in Salt Lake City getting set to screen the Talking Heads concert documentary.
Yes.
Stop Making Sense. And I'm sure that there's a portion of our listening audience who has no idea who Talking Heads even are. But they're the weird and phenomenal 80s band led by David Byrne. And the documentary was a collaboration between the band and the filmmaker whose name I can't remember now.
Jonathan Demme.
Jonathan Demme.
Who recently passed away.
Yeah, exactly. But giving them a chance to rescreen this at the Tower this weekend, and looks like something worth checking out. So Sean P. Means' story about that is my underplayed story of the week. Lee Davidson, Benjamin Wood, Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us today on Behind the Headlines.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks as well also to Thomas Burr, who joined us earlier on the program. We are going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Today, Kirby has some warnings from history for Utah hikers and outdoors enthusiasts. Robert, back in March, as part of your disturbing history series, you dug into a smattering of the many times that people have found bodies in Utah's mountains and backcountry. It's a fascinating but morbid topic, and a sort of unifying facet of all of these people that you wrote about is that they were often discovered by hunters, and often decades after they had gone missing.
Nobody ever thinks that when they go hiking in the mountains, they're going to come across a corpse or somebody who's long been missing. But there are a lot of people who've gone missing in Utah, and we still don't know where they are.
Oh, it's the terrain, the landscapes that we have.
That's right. And it draws hikers and outdoors people, and they get into trouble when they're off by themselves.
You know, I thought about saving this story for Halloween, except for you wrote it almost as kind of a warning for the spring. Essentially, the warning is, be careful out there, for starters.
Well, there's two time periods. I mean, if you look at the dates on these things in the newspapers, there's two main periods when they get found. One is in the spring after the snows are gone and people are getting out in the mountains. And the other, obviously, is the deer hunt, when half of Utah's population relocates into the mountains for two or three days. Hunters come across bodies because typically they're hunting in areas where other hunters hunted and they went missing.
Yeah. And or hikers. I mean, this is another one that you kind of point out, is that may have been another common part of this, is people who were hiking by themselves. And
typically speaking, every one of these found bodies were by themselves.
So is the sort of lesson, don't hike alone, or make certain you tell people where you're going when you head out there?
The problem with hiking in the mountains is nobody ever tells people where they're going because they don't know until they get up there.
Yeah.
You know, they'll say, I'm going to this area, and they'll say, wow, I wonder what that mountain looks like on the other side. Yeah. And off they go without telling people about it. But the interesting thing to me about all of them is the resolutions that come years later. In fact, in the column I wrote about that, I said that a man named Don Pack had gone hiking in Mill Creek Canyon during the deer hunt. He was actually deer hunting, and he went missing. Mm-hmm. And that was in 1956. And I wrote in the column that his body was never found. But a relative contacted me when he saw the story and said, actually, yes, his body was found in 1986.
Oh, wow. So somebody said that was a resolved case.
Yes, it was. Yeah. And sometimes you throw these ideas about history out just so you'll get feedback from somebody who knows more about it than you do.
Well, disturbing history, definitely. And the mountains out there holding on to secrets, don't become one of those secrets is the sort of moral of your
right.
story.
Right.
That was Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby to end this edition of Behind the Headlines. His Disturbing History series appears every Saturday in the Tribune. And you can find all of his opinions, the full Kirby archives, at sltrib.com. Coming up next here on KCPW, we've got KCPW Presents and America Abroad, looking at a global approach to climate change in the wake of the Paris Climate Accord. You can find us on Facebook. We are at KCPW FM. That's at KCPW FM. And at Twitter, we are at KCPW. That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, to Tom Williams, Connor Rivers, and Krista Black at Utah Public Radio, and to the show's producer, Emily Means. Thanks to you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this program at our website, kcpw.org, or however you choose to get your podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks once again for joining us, and have a great weekend.